welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We're always interested in your thoughts. Drop us a note to indianaweekend@gmail.com with your suggestions and comments. Let us know what's going on where you are. It's that time of year. Great hopes, great cheer, a little nostalgia maybe for times past, and often some gratitude for the people who've made a difference in our lives. Today, a look back at three stories we did this year about hope, renewal, and the wonder of life. In Muncie, this year brought some good news for folks with disabilities. The Erskine Green Training Institute opened at the Courtyard Muncie at Horizon Convention Center. The first class of students just graduated in the spring, and some immediately applied for internships at the hotel where they trained, or the attached Three Wise Men restaurant, or at IU Health Ball Memorial Hospital. Megan Stevenson is the training center's director.
The Arc of Indiana, a non-for-profit, advocates for people with disabilities. So anything that is affecting the disability population, the Arc is going to get involved at some level. So over time, the unemployment rate in individuals with disability has become well known. And so that's an issue in the population that we, the ARC, advocates for. So the ARC wanted to start doing something to tackle this issue. So the idea of the hotel and the training institute came about 5 to 6 years ago. This ended up coming to fruition, was built. And so now we have students here who are out of high school, have a disability of some kind, and are receiving specialized training in one of three environments, the hotel, the restaurant, or the healthcare setting.
She said hospitality jobs may be especially well suited for people with certain conditions.
And this isn't across the board, but you know, a lot of individuals with disabilities like consistency in their day. They like to know what to expect, like similarity across day-to-day tasks. And in these types of jobs that we're training, there's some differentiation between the tasks that you have to do and what your days look like, but there's a lot of consistency in the jobs, which fits well with the learning styles of individuals with intellectual disabilities.
What do we know today, suppose, that we didn't know 30 or 40 years ago about how to help folks with disabilities and the importance of work and the importance of working?
Back then, you know, the individuals with disabilities were just wanting to be recognized in the school system. You know, education was a huge thing, just fighting for education. And so that was a big focus back then, is let's just get individuals with disabilities in the school system. And now that they're in the school system, inclusion is more common nowadays. Now it's, okay, that's school, but then when they get out of school, the next environment that they're in is the living and employment area. So now that all of, you know, that big movement that happened back then, getting these individuals in the school system, now they're out of school. And so now we need to be looking at employment and how do we embed them and include them in your typical employment settings.
And there's some challenges that some of these folks have. What does the training do to help them overcome that?
So a lot of our students can learn the job. Learning the job isn't the issue. It's they may need longer to learn the job. They may need more one-on-one teaching to learn the job versus just throwing them in and making them learn it on the job. And so with us, we've allowed a long amount of time to teach the job. And then our student staff ratio is pretty small. So our students are able to get a lot of one-on-one instruction that they need to initially learn the job. And then once they learn it, then, you know, we're good to go. It's just a matter of making sure that the type of intense training up front is provided, and we're able to provide that to our students who are coming through the training institute.
And some companies want to help, don't they?
Mm-hmm. So a lot of companies spend a lot of time trying to hire and spending time training new employees. So with our students, we are the ones training the students, and so employers are interested in getting our students because they're already trained. So they don't have to spend the amount of time that they would have to spend on a new employee training them because we've already trained them. So yeah, there might need some time for the generalization piece. You know, we've trained in this hotel and now they're in a different hotel. So making sure that they generalize some of those skills. But for the most part, they have the set of skills already. So now the employer doesn't have to spend a ton of time training, which employers like that.
Are there some compensating advantages that these people bring to jobs?
Yeah, so there's a lot of research out there where companies have made it, made an effort to hire individuals with disabilities to make their workforce more diverse. But then also research shows a few different things. One, there's a lower turnover rate. So if you look at the employees in a company with a disability and you compare them to employees without a disability, you see things such as less absenteeism. So individuals with disabilities, most of them are not going to be calling in for a day off, unlike, you know, employees without a disability. You see a lower turnover rate. So they stay at jobs longer than employees without a disability. So now that there's research and numbers and statistics coming out regarding this, more companies are wanting to jump on board with hiring this population.
Are there some companies that are pretty well known for doing this?
Yeah, so Walgreens is a big one. They were kind of the forefront in getting it out there. So they are explaining to other big companies who have warehouses, this is how we did it, this is how it works. And so they're kind of sharing their message. So companies like Lowe's, Best Buy are now kind of coming on board because of what Walgreens has shown in their company.
Megan Stevenson, director of the Erskine Green Training Institute, which opened this year in downtown Muncie, just before our visit. The Bureau of Labor Statistics says that unemployment among people with disabilities tops 80%, forcing many to seek public assistance. Hospitality, meanwhile, is said to be the world's fastest growing industry, according to a study by Eastern Michigan University. So the ARC of Indiana has set up what organizers say is the first statewide hospitality training center for people with disabilities. Good news this year.
Indiana Weekend, interesting people and places from across our region. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line. Let us know what you think at indianaweekend@gmail.com. Now here's John Strauss.
Looking back as 2016 draws to a close at some of the inspiring people and stories we met this year on Indiana Weekend. We visited a camp half an hour south of Indianapolis with a very special mission. Bradford Woods provides recreation therapy for children with disabilities and illnesses. They also do environmental education for school and other groups. For companies and other groups, they also do leadership training, challenge courses with a huge climbing tower and zip lines. Tim Street is the camp's associate director.
Bradford Woods is Indiana University's outdoor center. What ended up happening was the Bradfords owned this property back in the day in the late 1800s. They actually found sand on the property that was really valuable. And they mined it off the property. They became very rich and they accumulated a lot of land. And then in the 1940s, there were three brothers and two sisters. When the last brother was alive in the late 30s, early 40s, he ended up deeding it to IU. And the idea at the time was that it would be used in perpetuity as a safe place for kids, as an educational environment for kids. And pretty much right away, we started partnering with Riley Children's Foundation. They were original partners as well. Because John Bradford, who was the last brother alive, was also friends with James Whitcomb Riley and Herman B. Wells at the time, who were the big players in each of those organizations. And so right away, it came over to IU. It took a few years for them to sort of build up infrastructure and get this place ready to have camps. And in 1955, we hosted the first Camp Riley, which was for kids with chronic illness and disabilities. The first camps back in the 50s tended to be for polio and diabetes. But over the years, the camps have morphed and changed, and we have a lot of different kids with chronic illnesses and disabilities. Some of them are totally unique, coming to us from Riley Children's Hospital and from other organizations.
They have five program areas, including recreation therapy and a camp for children with chronic illnesses and disabilities.
We have our environmental education area. That encompasses fifth graders coming out to Bradford Woods, learning about the environment, spending time away from their normal classroom environment and getting hands-on learning. We do adventure education, which is team building and facilitation on our low and high challenge courses. And we work with all different kinds of groups for that. It could be churches, schools, sports teams, faith-based organizations, private families, corporations, you name it. We have all those different types of groups coming out here and practicing with us, learning better communication, better leadership skills through our team courses. We also have retreats, which is people come out and they just want to enjoy this beautiful place. They want to rent a cabin for the weekend for their family or for their church. They'll come out and just rent space with us. And then lastly, we have the equine therapy, and we partner with Agape Therapeutic Riding. They're our nonprofit partner, and they provide all of our equine therapy down at our equine center.
The camp is 2,500 acres, and it can be a busy place.
I can think back and remember a few weekends here where we've had multiple groups on the property at once, and just representing an incredibly diverse population. One in particular I'm thinking of, I remember we had a group of inner city kids from Chicago who'd never really experienced nature before that were out here for a retreat getaway. We had a large faith-based organization using one of our villages. We had another group spending time from a support organization coming out and doing counseling and support. We had senior citizens out here because of our unique accessible setting. They were able to come out and sort of do a pseudo camp out with us and get away from their nursing home. And I just remember thinking on that weekend how uniquely powerful this place is because of all of these different groups we can reach and different populations, different ages, different backgrounds. And it's just really incredible to see how those groups can come out here and how they can be changed by experiences here at Bradford Woods.
Accessibility is a theme here.
Yeah, so Bradford Woods is designed from the ground up to be universally accessible. And that means, unlike if you were in a wheelchair and you went to a movie theater, there would be a couple rows of seats that are accessible to you. Whereas here at Bradford Woods, our design is not to have a couple rows of seats accessible to you, but the whole movie theater. And so all of our cabins, all of our entryways, our amphitheater, all of these different places have been designed to be 100% accessible to people with all types of abilities, people in wheelchairs, people with walkers, ambulatory folks. It doesn't matter. All of our facilities are universally designed. And that extends not just to, you know, buildings and sidewalks and things like that, but it extends to our activities. So, for example, our zip line. We can take kids or adults with chronic illness, disability, in wheelchairs, walking. We can get them ready to go and send them on our zip line, and it's a really powerful experience to have that available to everyone.
Tim Street of Indiana University's Bradford Woods Outdoor Center in Martinsville. The camp provides recreational, educational, and leadership development for youth and adults. Part of their mission is to work with special needs children, a mission we thought about as we sought to sum up this year and the people who inspired us.
I'm learning to fly, but I ain't got wings. Coming down is the hardest thing.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
The year draws to a close, and as it does, we're recalling some special people and moments, including, you would have to say, the Indiana Bicentennial. And the state's 200th birthday reminds us that, considering we're in a state named for the Indians, and with so many place names that draw upon that history, it turns out there's a lot we don't know about the Native Americans and their history in Indiana. Anderson, Delaware County, Muncie, Yorktown, just a few of the places that owe their names to tribes or Native American leaders. We might forget sometimes that Native Americans lived here for 2,000 years before Indiana became a state, so it's natural in this Hoosier Bicentennial year to look at their history as well. A book this year from Chris Fluke, Native Americans of East Central Indiana, should help fill in some of the gaps. The book is from the History Press's American Heritage series. I talked with Chris in Muncie for a show earlier this year. It was a rainy morning on his screened-in back porch, where he does most of his riding. He says the book is organized in two sections.
Well, I thought there was a pretty big hole in public knowledge for local history of Native Americans. So it's a history that goes back literally thousands of years. There's evidence of people living here thousands of years. So the first part of the book is really honestly not a history. It is an overview or a survey of sorts of the published archaeological knowledge of the Native groups that lived in this area, with a focus on the Newcastle phase Native Americans, which were sort of an offshoot of the Adena and the Hopewell that lived here about 2,000 years ago. And then I cover a little bit about the post-contact Native Americans in the second half, with an emphasis on the Delaware or the Lenape, who lived here from basically the end of the Northwest Indian War until 1821.
They really weren't here all that long, right?
No, a very, very brief period of time. 1795, 1796, the land in this immediate area at that time was essentially vacant and had been a hunting area or territory of the Miami. If you've ever taken a canoe down the White River, you know that you spend more time out of the canoe pulling it through the sludge. You know, it's just not that much of a navigable river. So the Miami had used it as a hunting area, and so the Delaware were invited to live there. And then, you know, within 30 years, white settlement had encroached again into Indiana, and so they were pushed further west.
The Lenape had an experience and a history of being pushed back a lot.
Yeah, and there are some historians that suggest that they're probably the most oft-moved tribe. They're nowhere from here. They're from what we now call the Delaware and the Hudson Rivers out east along the Atlantic coast. And then over a 200, 300-year period, they just were pushed first into eastern Pennsylvania, then western Pennsylvania, then eastern Ohio, then Fort Wayne briefly, and then here, and then Missouri, then Kansas, and then Oklahoma, the main group that was here. But there are others that are spread all through the United States and Canada.
Where did the Delaware get their name?
The Delaware, their autonym, the name that they give themselves even today, they would refer to themselves as Lenape, which just means the people. And they lived in the Hudson River, what we now call the Hudson River area, Delaware River area. The second governor of Virginia had some weird British title. He was known as the Lord Delaware. And so the native groups in and around that area in northern Virginia, what we now call Delaware, New Jersey, were known as Delaware's Indians and just Delaware Indians. And then that name just stuck as they moved further west.
So the Lenape kept getting pushed back. In their tradition, did they talk about this? Did they commiserate about it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and when the Europeans first came, there was a Lenape people, but they were a decentralized ethnic group. There were God knows how many different villages. There was no titular chief. Each village had a sachem, or like a strong man of sorts, that sort of in a council. And the closest equivalent, I'm not even sure this is an exact analogy, would be like the Greek city-states in Hellenic Greece. You know, you had a Greek people, but you had the Spartans were the Spartans, and then the Athenians were the Athenians. And it's an approximate analogy that you had all these decentralized villages, and there was no one person that could speak. And as they got pushed west, they sort of formed a centralized structure that the way that we sort of understand today.
We were talking on his screened-in back porch where Chris Fluke does his writing. There was a late morning rain, so you may hear some of that in the background. They lived along the White River. I mean, Marion, Muncie, Anderson, yep. what today we call these places.
That's right. So there were as many as 14 village sites starting from just south of Muncie at the reservoir, going through Muncie into Yorktown, Anderson, all the way down to Connor's village, where Connor Prairie is now, and then a village called Bruay's Village, which was probably a trading village just inside the Marion County line. In Delaware County, there were 4 known village sites.
And Muncie got its name from...
That's right. So one of the reasons I started researching on the book like 10 years ago was that there were... I had grown up embarrassingly thinking that there was a Chief Muncie. And there's not at all. There was
But that's probably what people here would
yes,
say, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Smart. And I like to think of myself as a smart person. There was no Chief Muncie. And Muncie is a dialect, one of 3 main dialects that we know of the Lenape people. And they weren't really a sub tribe, but they, because they spoke a different language, they sort of, when they were pushed west, they lived in sort of their own communities. And so the Munsee Lenape speakers lived in a village just north of the bend of the river, about the place where Minna Trista is now, and the five Ball Brother homes, or now four Ball Brother homes. And it was known by early settlers as the Munsee Village, and then it
became, so they would have been kind of up on that bank, that's too, right. So they didn't get flooded out all the time.
Yeah, it's hard to see today because of the Army Corps of Engineers in the 20s or the 30s came through and has dug the levee system. But the river was on par, you know, or level with the rest of the Munsee, and it constantly flooded. So most of the Lenape villages are on bluffs or high points above the river, and even then it didn't always protect them.
And there were these different clans, right? So the name for animals.
Yeah, there were what they referred to as fratries, and they're matrilineal. They're not really clans because there were subclans, but they're matrilineal groups, turkey, wolf, and turtle, that they used to organize what family you belong to. And it came through, unlike, I mean, it's very common for Algonquian speakers, it came through the female line, and it's basically just so you don't marry your cousin, you know, like just in the way that we'd sort of organize it today with the male names. And then each of those fratries had maybe like 12 clans. So that was one system that developed just basically for the descent group. And then they had the speakers, the Unami and the Munsee speakers, and they weren't the exact same system, but the, you know, sort of as they were pushed inward, sort of developed this really dynamic sort of setup.
Talking with Chris Fluke, who teaches telecommunications at Ball State, about his book, Native Americans of East Central Indiana. It's available at Minna Trista in Munsee, through bookstores, and via Amazon. It's a good reminder in this Hoosier Bicentennial year of our history and the stories of our state. Thanks for joining us in this holiday edition of Indiana Weekend, featuring a second listen at some conversations we had with interesting and inspiring Hoosiers. Oh, just a quick thought now that we're so close to the end of the year. Could you keep your public radio friends in mind? A gift this time of year really helps. Please give us a call at 1-800-646-1812 to renew your membership or throw a little more in, or go to indianapublicradio.org. And thanks. And that's our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Sean Ashcraft, and the folks in the front office, including your friends Matt Bloom, Connie Clary, Lori Georgie, Emily Kowalski, Andrea Lutz, John Morgan, Angie Rapp, Debbie Webb, Alicia Franklin, and Elena McKenzie. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Sean Ashcraft. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from IPR's listeners. We hope you'll join your friends who are IPR members. You can go to indianapublicradio.org or give us a call at 1-800-646-1812. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.